Everyone, welcome back to another episode of Mind Shift Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. I am your fellow traveler along this journey of deconstruction and discovery, questioning our inherited beliefs, questioning our constructed worldviews, because after all, most of the time, our worldviews are little more than a shell that we use to protect ourselves. We all suffer from confirmation bias, that is, this idea that we only accept in the things that agree with what we already think, what we already believe, and if something doesn't agree with our preconceived ideas or our presuppositions, we ignore it, we throw it out, we reject it, and all too often what ends up happening is we attack, we vilify the person who represents that alternative points of view. We see it, for example, in debates over gun control in America, politics on the left or the right. And among Christians, of course, we see this all the time. Debates about theology, interpretations of the Bible, homosexuality, abortion, gay marriage, you name it, there's going to be a debate, an argument, and it's going to be one side against the other. It's this very binary thinking that explains why I started this podcast, why I changed the name to Mind Shift, because it's all about learning how to think critically, and we do this by engaging with other, more alternative points of view than perhaps we would normally be exposed to, and it helps us to think critically about things like God, the state of the church today, and spirituality. And what better way to do that than by finishing my conversation that I started last week with Andrew Gurevich from Portland, Oregon. If you listened to the episode last week, you'll remember the story. He and I went to Bible college together. We ended up going to seminary together. But his story is a truly unbelievable one. Raised by a dad who was in the mafia, he suffered all kinds of horrific sexual, physical, verbal, emotional abuse as a child. And when he was a teenager, he ended up becoming a Christian. He joined a church, and the most compelling thing about it was, as he talked about, the message that the church preached, love for the Father. And you can certainly see why a kid who's coming up in such a horrific, abusive, toxic environment, whose own father is so terribly abusive and angry, why he would be drawn to this notion that God the Father would offer that kind of love and acceptance and community, and all these things were found in the church. But as time went on and he was pursuing ministry and academics, he went off to Bible college and then later on into seminary. And this, of course, if you remember the story, that's where he and I met in the early 1990s in Bible college in Portland. And we played in worship bands together. We did ministry together. But over time, what ended up happening was that he could no longer live with his cognitive dissonance. He began to notice that there were some wedges that were beginning to drive him out of the evangelical church. Things like social issues and the theological problems that he began to wrestle with. And ultimately, he was unable to reconcile these things with his own belief system and his own worldview that he was developing in this process of deconstruction and discovery. And eventually, he walked away from the church, became an angry atheist, and was shaking his fist at an empty sky, as he talked about. Now, in today's episode, we're going to be going on into his interest in Paleolithic rock art. We've got a lot of ground to cover in this second half. We're going to go from apophatic theology. What in the world is that? We're going to get into neurology. We're going to get into politics. And eventually, we're going to somehow tie all that together with Andrew's interest in Paleolithic rock art. So stay tuned for that coming up in just a few minutes. But before we get into that, I wanted to reflect on something that I was thinking about this week as I listened to last week's podcast. And of course, I've been listening to this week's conversation that we're about to come into in just a few minutes. It struck me that, you know, the evangelical church oftentimes gets itself in trouble because it paints itself into a corner in a way. We see this with doctrines like inerrancy, for example, this idea that the Bible is 100% without error. But of course, the problem is, if you accept that position, if, for example, an error or a mistake were to be found in the Bible, then your whole faith falls apart. Another one is this idea of young earth creationism, the idea that the earth is somewhere around 6 to 10,000 years old. And we're going to be getting into that in this episode in just a few minutes. But what struck me about that was I came across a tweet from Blake Chastain of the Exvangelical podcast and the Exvangelical Facebook group. And I think Blake hit it right on the head. We see this most typically in people who have left the church behind, who have walked away from organized religion, fundamentalism, and evangelicalism. Because they've accepted these positions, because they've made them their own, and this was their worldview, this was their very identity, they feel a sense of betrayal when they finally realize, as Andrew did, that they can no longer live with that sense of cognitive dissonance, that their positions that they used to hold and even defend have really become untenable. So here's what Blake Chastain had to say about this issue. He says, quote, "So one theme that's been rolling around my head over the past few days has been one of the key things of exvangelical experience, a sense of betrayal by your elders. This may include your family of origin or it may not, but it will almost certainly include your faith of origin or your most formative faith experience, evangelicalism itself. This sense of betrayal manifests itself in several ways, and because evangelicalism is a religious, social, and political movement, all bleeding into and informing one another, these betrayals have various origins." And he goes on to say, "This is a result of evangelicalism presenting itself as a cohesive worldview. You, like me, may have been taught by some variety of viewing the world, quote-unquote, from a biblical Christian worldview. This worldview is presented as supreme and unquestionable." He says, "What is often hidden from view, but easily found by inquisitive students, is that this view is dependent on multiple faulty presuppositions. Biblical literalism, gender, heteronormative patriarchy, white supremacy, and American exceptionalism, to name a few." And Blake says, "Evangelicalism can be challenged and questioned on any of these fronts, and is on a daily basis. Each presupposition is antagonistic to a healthy, pluralistic democracy." And he goes on to say, "Many ex-evangelical persons no longer identify as evangelical, not because of a sense of blind anger, but because they were taught something that later proved out to be false, as confirmed by personal experience and other more objective facts." And Blake goes on to give a few examples of how this works in the real world. He says, for example, "A young girl loves geology and God and understands the sedimentary layers are built up over millions of years. She is taught the world is only 6,000 years old. She is given a choice between cognitive dissonance or a disavowal of one of two things she loves." And so, he says, they are pushed out of evangelicalism because they do not adhere to the norm. In this way, he says, many are betrayed by their faith communities that teach a simple, cohesive world that does not match with the complex world we all actually inhabit. And what's the result? He says, the betrayal comes first. Anger often follows. This is not merely an intellectual exercise. And he concludes his statement when he says, their hearts are torn asunder, end quote. And what strikes me about reading that series of tweets by Blake Chastain is that I think he's really hit it on the head. If you grew up in church like me, you were taught a fairly simplistic worldview that was a quote-unquote biblical worldview, but it was actually built on a fairly literalistic reading of the Bible. But herein lies the very problem. What happens when the evidence that you begin to discover out there in the real world doesn't really line up at all with what you've been taught is this supposed biblical worldview? Oftentimes, as Blake says, there's a sense of anger. Now, this is something that Andrew and I are going to get into in this episode, because as we start talking about Paleolithic cave art, we're talking about a civilization that dates back 25, 30, 40,000 years ago. These ancient nomadic civilizations actually predate all the normal conventions that we use to describe ourselves, whether it's ethnic or religious or political or nationalistic or whatever you want to say to describe yourself. And it's a shared humanity. And this is something that I ask Andrew in this episode. Now, I want to say before we get into the conversation with Andrew, I want to mention coming up next Friday is the first half of a conversation that I had recently with David Fitzgerald. He is an atheist and he is the author of the book Nailed, 10 Christian Myths That Show Jesus Never Existed at All. We're going to get into the historicity of Jesus, the historical record. We're going to look at the Gospels as well as the writings of Paul, and it's an absolutely fantastic and challenging discussion. Okay, let's go on into part two. Let's finish up the conversation with Andrew Gurevich as we delve further into these issues of apophatic theology, neurology, politics on the left as well as on the right, and finally, Paleolithic rock art. You might be saying to yourself, I don't even know what half these words mean, let alone how they tie in with each other. For that matter, I've got no idea either how they all connect. Let's let Andrew do it. So here we go, off into part number two.
Picking up on what you said earlier, talking about having that sense of arrogance that we claim as Christians, that we know all the answers about God, we've got all the rules in the Bible, and you know we have the way, the only way to salvation, to heaven. That's a very arrogant viewpoint. I wanted to pick up on something you said too. You talked about being a prophet. One of the things that we talked about in our pre-interview was you consider yourself a progressive politically. But one of the things I've noticed over the years is that you have just as much critiques of the left as much as the conservative side. And you get into a lot of trouble on Facebook for that. But that's one of the things I appreciate about you is that you're just as willing to call out stuff that you see on the progressive side as much as critiquing Trump and Roy Moore and people and the evangelical church. How do your progressive friends kind of view you? Do they roll their eyes every time you start in again?
Man, I'll tell you, that's a huge question. And I'll lead into that with this, just one other theological point I was going to bring up. There's something I've been really, and then it'll lead into the answer to your question. There's something I've been into a lot lately, which is a phrase called apophatic theology, and that's A-P-H-O-P-H-A-T-I-C. And it's a branch of both Jewish and Christian theological thinking that really quickly has to do with the theology of negation. It has to do with this idea that no concept or model of God that we produce is complete, right? Anything we come up with in terms of how to define or understand or approach the deity is necessarily incomplete.
Right.
And so because of that, again, just like with mysticism, we have to approach the throne room, so to say, with some humility, with some wonder, and a healthy dose of awe. And you know, a couple of quick examples of how that works out in theology, and then I'll mention why I brought that up here in relationship to your question. You know, Hebrews, Jews, when they see the name of God, when they see Yahweh written in the text, when in ceremony or when they're reading the text aloud, they will substitute, they won't say the word Yahweh, they'll either say Hashem, which simply means the name, or they'll say Adonai, which just means Lord, like an overlord or a landlord or something, right? Somebody in authority over you. But they don't say God's name directly, because to do so is just untoward. It's seen as just a bit too egotistical, and also it's a reminder of the fact that what God is not even contained within that name. And then things like the attributes of God, when we say God is immortal or immutable, then these attributes are based on things that God lacks. God lacks the ability to die. God lacks the ability to change.
Right?
And even if we call God beautiful or perfect, that means that God is without blemish. That's what these things mean. Without sin, without corruption. And so many of the attributes of the deity really center around concepts about what the deity isn't. And even there, we're supposed to understand that even that calculation is partially incomplete. So in terms of speaking to our previous topic, I'm much more interested in a way of interacting with the divine that is characterized by that humility and that wonder and that awe and that caution and that the kind of open integration than I am in these rigid kind of hostile and aggressive and fundamentalist models. Now, to your question about the American left, yes, I kind of experienced the same thing, didn't I? I left the church and suddenly got embraced by a bunch of tofu-eating, gender-fluid, recycling leftists with mohawks and purple hair and, you know, everything, the whole Portlandia scene. And the same kind of thing, man. I felt finally I found my home and I found my family and I found this place where you're truly accepted and if you're different, you're truly embraced. But over time, this is just a nature, an aspect of humans and human community more than it is something that particularly the church or Christians are guilty of. Over time, you start to see the cracks in the ideology over here as well. And especially through social media, man, and we can have a whole episode about how I think that's changing consciousness. But I have a friend who's an Orthodox, Russian Orthodox priest, and he watches a lot of these interactions I have on Facebook all the time. And the left has its own purity culture. The left has its own kind of pharisaical way of doing things. You know, the Old Testament Torah has, 613 various commandments that are all supposed supposed to be followed in order to hold the law. And my Orthodox priest friend was commenting, watching a few of these interactions, and he said, man, you, some of your liberal friends would give Levitical priests for their money. And it cracked me up, because what he was referring to is this idea that there's a kind of legalism on the left among certain folks in the activist community that has the same kind of attitude, that we have all the answers to what ills the world. Anybody who disagrees with us is an idiot and is, or worse. And these following 700 things are the things that must be done and said in order to make the world pure. And if you violate any of them, you run the risk of being ostracized by the entire community. And I see the same thinking on members of the left. I run into it daily with folks. And you know, whether it's the Me Too movement, or whether it's, you know, these women's marches, or whether it's the anti-Trump stuff, there's so much good stuff that's coming out of all of that. And I'm certainly no supporter of the current president. But when you try to talk to some of these same folks about how the previous president dropped bombs on poor people for every single day of his two terms in office, first time that's ever happened in U.S. history, or how the previous president deported more people in 2016 than the current president did in 2017, or some of the real problems with the neoliberal Clinton-Obama-Clinton cabal, and how that hasn't actually worked out well for the country and for the world in many, many ways. When we look at the people of Honduras or the people of Libya, right, who have been utterly, utterly devastated by these Clinton-Obama regimes. There's a lot in terms of national and international awareness to where the left in this country is just not being honest or self-aware. And one of the problems with rigid partisanship in a country that's gone astray is that half the population is always comfortable with totalitarian rule about 50% of the time. Once your guy gets in, then you go back to not paying attention while they rob the place blind for all of the special interest groups that put them in office. And then you fight and fight, and then the other guy gets in, and now all of a sudden all of my friends are wanting to get rid of Trump and literally almost have the same thing. The Make America Great Again. There's this idea that if we get rid of the guy, we can go back to being this wonderful, wholesome, beautiful place. And I try to point out, I know I'm being long-winded, but I'll just say this and stop. I try to point out to people that if you have a clear awareness of history, which is part of what it is to be a prophet, right? The way you can tell the future is by reading the past, is by watching human behavior over and over again and guessing, usually rightly so, that we're going to do the same things we've always done. And you go back through American history, you know, Abraham Lincoln, right before he signs the Emancipation Proclamation, orders the largest murder of American citizens in U.S. history with the Wounded Knee Massacre. Thomas Jefferson had a dungeon, literally had a room in his house where he kept female slaves and the children he fathered with them, forced them in, you know, he kept them in this confined space. And so literally a sex dungeon in his house. And when we found this a little under 100 years ago, we hushed it up and turned the thing into a men's restroom so good patriotic Americans could piss all over the remains of this crime scene for years to come. And so we are nothing even close to a nation with clean hands, really since our inception. And one of the things I appreciate about Christianity, I'll say this and stop, and other spiritual systems, is that there is no movement for transformation. There is no way to transform the society. There is no way to transform the world that doesn't start with a rigorous self-examination and a transformation of one's own heart. And I see that sometimes on the far evangelical right, they're so worried about gay marriage and abortion and the age of the earth and homeschooling that they forget to do the self-examination that it requires in order for them to truly be righteous people. And I see it on the left just as much. We fall into this notion that if we just get rid of Jeff Sessions, if we just get rid of Paul Ryan, if we could just get Joe Kennedy in there, or if we could just get Kamala Harris in there, then everything is going to be all right. And really what that means to me is that there are whole swaths of the country that just want to go back to not paying attention and not being engaged. And if they can get somebody from their, you know, partisan perspective in there, then they feel like, well, I got somebody in there that represents my ideology, and I can go back to not caring now. And I see that just as much on the left as I do on the right, especially living here in Portland. And lastly, there's this idea that we have all the answers, and try to talk to a diehard progressive sometime about any good ideas that conservatives have. And I'm sure you'll get the same brick wall as if you talk to a hardcore conservative.
Yeah,
right, and ask them any good ideas that progressives have. But if you can't get people to connect over their shared humanity, forget about nationality, but just their shared humanity, in order to build social systems that serve us all equally and fairly, then we're beyond lost. And that is not just a problem of Trump and his supporters by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about tribalism. I mean, you see it in places. When we were in Kenya in Africa in 2001, one of the things I asked some of the nationals there, I said, what's the biggest problem that you have as a country today? And they said, well, the after effects of colonialism. And they said the other issue is tribalism, because what happens is the ancient animosities that go back thousands of years between the tribes, as soon as one tribe gets in power, the first thing they do is subjugate the tribe that they've hated for thousands of years. And then when the other tribe gets back in power, they oppress the last tribe. So it's basically the same thing in American politics, isn't it? Because you're saying once the Democrats get elected in this midterm election, they're going to impeach Trump and everything's going to be great again. And yet it wasn't so great maybe in the past. Speaking of tribalism, we got to get to rock art. The last thing we need to talk about, because it reminds me of tribes. Can you kind of briefly talk us through what is this, your interest in rock art, and what are the implications of it in terms of the spirituality as well?
Yeah, man. Again, I'll try to lead into that by saying two things that relate to the last question, but kind of lead me into answering this one. Another thing I forgot to say about my caution, not just with the left, but just with tribalism and in American politics and in our notion of world religions as well, is this kind of outrage addiction. And I see this a lot on social media. Anything that we commit ourselves to requires energy, and rage requires a lot of energy, right? And yes. And there's definitely such a thing as righteous anger. There's definitely such a thing as speaking up for communities or for individuals who have been harmed, who maybe don't have influence and power, and who are being hurt by policies. I don't discourage people from speaking up and giving voice to their anger when they feel that others, whether it be politicians or somebody in a relationship or my own students, right, if they feel like something's happening that isn't fair and is harming them, they definitely should speak to it and speak to it with the amount of presence and anger that they feel the situation requires. But when I go on, I get up in the morning, I'll make a cup of tea, and I'll go on Facebook or Twitter, and I just see one post after the next. Did you see what Trump said today? He said shit all countries. Did you see he went golfing? Did you see what he did? Did you see what he said? Right, and I see these people, just one post after the next, where they are exhausting themselves by being just outraged. They spend all day, every day, doing very little but being mad at Trump. And that's not a policy for building strong community, right? This is very similar to what the right did. So they spent 8 years being pissed off at Obama and basically just going, F Obama, F Obama, no, 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 no. And then when they got in power and had to put a health care bill together, they didn't have one ready, because for 8 years, all they knew was F Obama.
Yeah, it was a stone.
Right. And so the left is falling into the same kind of idea. It's just screw Trump, screw Trump, screw Trump. And it's like, do you have a plan for governing the people? Well, no, but screw Trump. And so we... I find this thing tends to mirror itself on both sides. And in an area, and you know, to come to your question on the rock art, an area of study that I've also put a lot of work into over the past 10 years is neurology and neuropsychology. I think this is the second great advancement after the invention of psychoanalysis itself, for us understanding some really deep things in terms of the way we layer our cognitive abilities and move through the world. And this was a science that was picked up a lot in the 60s, so this right brain versus left brain stuff. But at the time, we didn't really have the ability to, you know, in the imaging and the science to back it up. And back then, we made these simple kinds of things like left brain controls logic and the right brain controls creativity and the left brain controls language and the right brain controls images, right? And it turns out that none of that stuff was true, that both hemispheres are involved in both of those things. And so the science was kind of ditched for about 20 years. But starting in the 90s, it was picked up again because there's something there. Our brain is in two halves, and they each do work differently. They do work in tandem, but they work differently as well. And so once we got some better imaging and some better tools, we jumped back into this. And I'll mention three people quickly, and I'll tell you why I'm bringing this up, and then I'll jump into the rock art thing. But a guy named Jeremy Rifkin wrote a book called The Empathic Civilization. There's also a great TED Talk by the same name. Another guy is from your neck of the woods. His name is Ian McGilchrist, and he wrote a wonderful book called The Master and His Emissary. He has a great TED Talk, and both of these, I think the best ones to watch are the RSA, the Royal Society for the Arts, animated versions. He has a great TED Talk. TED Talk called The Divided Brain. And then a woman named Jill Bolte Taylor has a great book and TED Talk called The Stroke of Insight. And in all three, they're talking about this idea of how the brain actually works on cognition. And I don't want to go way into it. I'll let you, you know, you and your listeners go check it out. But basically what they're saying is this, is that the right hemisphere works in a way to make us aware of our larger connection to everyone and everything around us. That your right hemisphere situates you in deep connectivity to your environment, right? And your left hemisphere individuates you from your environment. And so it's that calculating intelligence that, you know, tells you, oh, I have to do the laundry today, or I have 10 minutes before I have to get to class or whatever, right? And that's your left brain doing that. Your right brain is working when you go to the ocean or to the mountains and have that kind of transformative experience of feeling deeply connected, or a family gathering, or looking at old family photos or something, right? And the reason this matters is if these religions are various technologies for helping us access and expand mythological and symbolic consciousness, then they're going to, for them to really speak to the whole person, they're going to have developed techniques, images, rituals in order to speak to both aspects of the person. And so all of that to say, for a religion to function in the hearts and minds of people, it has to speak for their entire nervous system. By the way, including the somatic nervous system, which is the one that's held in the gut, which is why so many religions have rituals that involve food and the sacredness of eating. But if a religion's going to be successful in speaking to the whole person, it's going to have to have rituals and aspects of it, of the technology, that speak to the individual. That like you said earlier when I was ramping up about all the stuff that I was talking about with myth, you asked the question, how does this work in the day-to-day for the average person? And that's a left-brain question. And for a myth or a symbol system to be functional, it's got to answer that question. You know, so what? And I talked to you about that, you know, the Bible story of Jacob wrestling with the angel of the Lord.
Yes.
And how when I overinterpret that and I think about it too much as a literal historical event, it becomes almost inaccessible to me because it seems weird, it's archaic, it's bizarre, it's a little bit scary, it's a little bit homoerotic. It has nothing to do with my life, except for the homoerotic part, but nothing to do with my actual day-to-day, right? But then when I think about what it is in a metaphorical sense to wrestle with God, to wrestle against my higher self, to wrestle against that voice that tells me how I should behave in a situation, that if a guy cuts me off on the road and I want to honk at him and flip him off, there's a voice in me that knows I shouldn't, right? And so how do I respond to that voice? And that's me wrestling, quote-unquote, with the angel of God. And when I interpret it that way, the thing becomes more accessible to me. But that's really my right and left hemispheres bouncing the symbol around, trying to find an access point, trying to find, as the Buddhists would say, a Dharma gate, a way into my consciousness to make the thing resonate. And so my work with rock art, that's a long way just to get to this, but my work with rock art started, you know, back, I guess it would have been 2008 or so. Werner Herzog came out with a movie called Cave of Forgotten Dreams, and it was about some rock art that was found in a cave in southern France. There's a cave network that goes from southern England all the way into Spain, through France, and into Germany, and it's these Paleolithic caves that are back 16 to 25,000 years ago, and there's this amazing, beautiful art painted in these caves. And at the time when this movie came out, the earliest rock art that had ever been discovered in the world of a certain level of complexity was this art that was in a place called the Chauvet Cave in southern France. And watch the film. It was in 3D. Beautiful film. I recommend it to you and to your audience to go check it out. But what I noticed in the movie were two things. One was that they didn't have any mythologists or religious experts with them on this team. They had anthropologists, art historians, archaeologists, but they didn't have anybody who was actually an expert in religious symbolism. And they made several mistakes because of that. One is they think that because these images were painted on the wall thousands of years ago from people that aren't here anymore and didn't leave us written instructions as to what they were doing, that these images are incomprehensible to us now. And the second mistake that they made, I believe, was that the images aren't connected to one another. You know, if you go into an Egyptian tomb and you see a series of images on the wall as you move through the tomb, you're fully aware that you're being told a story and that the images are connected and sequential. And as you move through the tomb, you're moving through this narrative. But for some reason, when we go into these Paleolithic caves, we make the opposite assumption. It's an assumption, and it's a totally erroneous one, right? And the other thing I noticed in the film was that these academics would go and experience this art. They would go into these caves and study this art, and almost to a person, they would have these profound experiences. It would start affecting their dreams. It would start, like, they would stutter when they were talking. They were deeply wound up and sort of agitated by these images, but they couldn't really speak to why and how and why it was doing that. And the other thing they did was they separated it from their scholarship. They were like, I'm having these dreams and it's freaking me out. And I don't know what's going on, but I'm a scholar and I just have to focus on this here. And I remember being so frustrated at the time, saying, like, yelling at the screen, going, no, you have to keep doing your scholarship and bringing your critical mind to this. But that experiential component is extremely important, because that thing you're saying that these images can't do, which is speak to us directly from the chasm of where they were written down for the first time 26,000 years ago, that's actually what's happening, right? When these researchers are in there and they're suddenly being profoundly shaken up and moved almost to tears by these images, and they're like, I don't understand this emotion, so I'm just going to set it aside and go back to studying these. My point was, no, you actually have to include that in your research, because that's what they're supposed to be doing.
So
I wrote an article about it that ended up being published. I was surprised that anyone cared as a cover story in Popular Archaeology. I think it was in March of 2013. And the joke I made at the time was I wasn't popular nor an archaeologist, and so I was extremely happy to get the piece in. And then it started me on this path of studying rock art and cave art. Written a few more things since then, and got to speak, you know, around the country on it. I haven't left the country to speak on it yet. I'd love to go to Europe actually and talk on these caves, but I haven't been able to do that. But I've been all over the country doing it. And just to wrap up, at least this part of it, what speaks to me about these images so profoundly is that they come from a time when we hadn't differentiated as a species yet. And what I mean by that is that once you hit 12,000 to 15,000 years ago, right, the earliest, stuff keeps getting earlier. There's new finds every day. Probably by the time you air this, what I'm about to say isn't going to be true anymore, because we keep making new discoveries. But Sumerian text, right, you know, really the first sort of high civilization, we don't start seeing, you know, until 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. Some stuff in Çatalhöyük and Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. But much before 12,000 years ago, we don't really have many examples of specified human culture. So, you know, French or German or Italian or Jew or Christian or Muslim or Hindu or, you know, all these things that really specify a group of people according to a set of experiences and their interpretation of that experience that makes it distinctively different than other human experience. And so the Hindu experience is not the Judeo-Christian experience. The Muslim experience is not the Jewish experience. The French experience is not the German or Japanese experience, right? We have commonalities as humans, obviously, but we've been so embedded in these various cultural layers over so many thousands of years that it becomes really difficult to see one another outside of all of those frames. And the power of these images to me is that they come from a time before all of that. We had some loose tribal affiliations at the time, but they were loose and people were migratory and moved around the planet and intermarried and interconnected. And these come from a time when these are human images. They're not Christian images. They're not Muslim images. They're not Hindu images. They're human images. And there's not too many artifacts of religious and spiritual significance that literally belong equally to all of humanity, right? And so I started calling them our original inheritance, because they're a rare set of sacred images that speak to the heart and mind of every human on this planet equally, and it exists in the spiritual heritage and trajectory of every person on this planet equally. And that's just historically true, right? And so because of that, I feel like they have the power, especially at a time when the world is so hostile and divided amongst itself, and I don't mean this in too much of a hippie way, but to bring people together. When you study these images and understand what they're communicating a profound connection to the land and to the cosmos and to other human beings that transcends all of these other ways we've devised at dividing ourselves from one another. These images, they came out of us before we invented all of those other things. And they speak to a deeper part of our interconnection. And And they just do. You don't have to get a PhD. You don't have to learn a bunch of theological concepts. You don't have to buy inerrancy and inspiration. And you don't have to, like, accept 45 theological concepts, philosophical concepts, in order to have these images mean something. They just mean something directly to you the first time you see them. They speak directly to your soul. And so because of that, I've just been on this mission to try to get them out into the world and get people seeing them and understanding them and talking about them. Because, again, I really do believe that if we can begin these conversations from a place of mutual kind of dignity and respect and kind of deep elemental cellular connection, then that provides the basis for anything else we might later discuss where we disagree. If that makes any sense. And disagreements can grow out of that ground, but it's a ground that has not already been polluted by such divisiveness and hostility. It's one that's instead kind of nourished by this shared kind of mythic and spiritual heritage.
Yeah,
does that make any sense?
Yeah, it strikes me too that we talked about this the other day, that your explanation of the age of these, of the rock art, that it predates these world religions and everything, that's got to be a major threat, not just to Christianity, but to Hinduism, Islam. You think, well, these religions are X number of thousands of years old, but this stuff predates all of that. And you'd have to think, as a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew or whatever, you this is going way back. What's the kind of reaction that you get? I mean, I know we got to kind of wrap it up, but what's the reaction that you get from Christians and people of faith when you start talking about the age of this rock art?
You know, it's mixed, to be honest with you. Again, that's another really great question. And like I said, I really see my role in the world now to walk with people into the sort of great complex mystery of their own spiritual experience. And so I've fallen away from this idea of trying to stick it to Christians. And so if I'm talking to a Christian person, I don't go, hey, let me tell you about this 40,000-year-old rock art. You know, I don't shy away from it, but it's not like I'm trying to bring it up so I can piss them off or freak them out or something. But when the subject does come up, I've had a mixed reaction. You know, as you know, it doesn't just mean one thing to be a Christian in the world. There are so many different denominations and so many different churches and so many different ways that people approach that. There are progressive of Christians. There are those that don't hold to this young earth theory. There are many believers that don't hold to this notion of counting up the genealogies in the book of Numbers in order to come up to this, you know, 8,000 or 9,000 year old earth kind of number. That there's nothing biblical about this idea of the earth being 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 years old. That this is kind of the extrapolation of a Catholic monk who decided to add genealogies up at some point. And so the evidence for a young earth, even within the scripture, is pretty scant. But like you said, it isn't just Christians that freak out about this. Hindus, who the Hindu religion is called the Sanatana Dharma. It's the British who called it Hinduism. Hindus themselves frequently refer to their own religion as Sanatana Dharma, which means the ageless or eternal religion. And we can trace its origins back, like I said, really to, 1200, 1400 BC in the Indus Valley region, to these two civilizations in particular, Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. So if you have something called the ageless religion, or frequently people have talked about Aboriginal religion being the first, and that does go back 25, 30, 40,000 years. And so you are starting to deal with something there that is pretty old. But people get freaked out by this age only if one or two things have happened, I've noticed. Only if they've been, I would say, erroneously conditioned into this idea that the earth and human culture and human religious activity is all very young and actually started recently, you know, 10,000 years ago. If they buy into that one particular biblical interpretation, which, as far as I can tell, is not required as a person of faith at all. And, or the other reason that people get hung up on this is related. It's that they're more concerned with being right than with getting close to the truth. And I think that there's a way that our own belief systems can become idols, that when we're protecting, you know, we build these shells around ourselves, these worldviews that are supposed to verify all the things we already believe and then vilify and dismiss all the things that threaten what we believe.
Yes.
And that's the way we tend to walk through the world, with this shell, with this shield. And we come across new ideas, and if they verify what we've already decided is true, then we let them in. And if they don't, then we dismiss them immediately. But this is, to me, this is no way to be. If we are sojourners out here really trying to get closer and closer to this great mystery of who we are and where we came from and what is our connection to this cosmos, and is it living or not, and is it conscious or not, and if it is conscious and if it is living, is it able and does it desire a relationship with us, and what does that mean, what does that look like, and does that mean one thing for all people for all time, or does that change? These are profound lifelong meditations and questions that we all have to grapple with. And when I find people that get weirded out when I start talking about the rock art, it's usually for one of those reasons. It's that they become more accustomed to their own sense of rightness about everything than they are a genuine quest to understand this cosmos we inhabit. And lastly, I think there's this other kind of bias that people have where they look at primitive peoples, quote unquote, and think these people from 20, 30, you know, even if they accept that people could have been alive 20 or 30, 40,000 years ago, they think they couldn't have possibly known what the fuck they were talking about, and they must have just been a bunch of ignorant savages, you know, that were hitting each other on the head and just, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. They can't imagine that these people had complex art, complex theological understandings of their connection to the universe. It just flies in the face of the kind of noble, simple savage. And I've even encountered that not from the church. I've encountered that from the sort of secular researchers in this field as well. I've done a lot of work. The further back you go into these kinds of religious iconography, the further back you go into what we would call goddess scholarship. The thought, when you go 20, 30, 40,000 years back, the deity that you encounter is a feminine deity, right? That there's all these cultures worship some form of this birth-giving, this life-giving feminine energy. And when you try to talk to many scholars about that, I read an article recently from the Smithsonian that said that these goddess figurines were just ancient porn. That these hunters that were going on long hunts, they would take these little statues with them as like pinup girls, just like we took Jane Mansfield and Marilyn Monroe off to, you know, World War II and Vietnam and stuff, that these were just like porn, travel porn for hunters of the day. And there's no evidence for that. It's just a way to dismiss these images and from their totemistic or their shamanic or you know, their mythological significance. And so you encounter a lot of resistance from folks because they're just not familiar with this. And so they think, boy, if this were real, I would have heard of this kind of stuff before. But we're learning so much literally day by day, where the numbers are moving backwards and we're making new discoveries. When I wrote that Show the Cave article, it is the oldest cave in existence, and now they found one in Sulawesi in Indonesia that's 40,000 years old. So it's a full 15,000 years younger than the one that I wrote my article about.
That's amazing.
And so this is such a wide area of study. We still know so little about it, but it holds such promise. And, you know, I've gotten some pushback, but again, I really think that comes from people that are clinging more to their constructed view of truth than they are to their desire to actually encounter it.
Yeah, it's emotionally threatening, isn't it? And we all suffer from confirmation bias, don't we? We find something that agrees with our preconceived ideas, and it must be the truth. Well, listen, man, we have covered a huge amount of ground. We've gone way into rock and roll and rock art and Christianity, atheism, all kinds of other things, but we should probably wrap it up. I've totally enjoyed this conversation. This has been absolutely amazing. I've learned a lot of stuff. I mean, it's really making me think, certainly, about so many things. Thank you so much, Andrew, for being a part of this podcast.
Hey, man, I really enjoy it, and I love what you're doing. I think podcasting is an absolute revolution out there, and you know, there are some great folks that are examining these issues of faith and consciousness, and I think you're doing a great job, and I'm really happy to be a part of it. I think I'll say this at the end. There are some pastors here in the States, a guy named John Shelby Sprong and another guy named Jim Rigby, who I think are doing amazing work in kind of being aware of social consciousness, of being aware of where the world is right now and what the world needs right now, but still fashioning their message and their approach to the gospel message in a way that totally is different from so many of the other things we are maybe accustomed to in the history of the church. And so there are some folks out there that are waking up and really trying to revitalize that message in a way that isn't so polarizing and isn't so archaic and isn't based on things like arguing over whether a guy could live in the belly of a fish for 3 days and arguing over if it's okay to be a lesbian and arguing over what it means to take the Lord's name in vain. All those things we just go down the rabbit hole on back in the day, which seems so interesting from a fundamentalist viewpoint, become almost meaningless when you're dealing with a world of suffering. But I'm encouraged to see not more than just a few seemingly devout Christian people out there that are trying to change that narrative. And so I'm keeping my eye on that, man. I look forward to see where that's going. And I look forward to see where your show's going in the future, man. I think this is absolutely vital, what you're doing. So thanks for having me on.
Well, I have no idea how Andrew Gurvich was able to do that. He tied apophatic theology, neurology, politics on the left as well as on the right, religion, spirituality, and Paleolithic cave art somehow together into one cohesive whole. I don't have a clue how he did it, but that's what I appreciate about having someone like Andrew on this podcast. This is a guy who has thought deeply, who has really studied a lot of perspectives and points of view quite intensively. And as a teacher of world religions and mythology and Paleolithic cave art and all the other things that Andrew's interested in, what it seems to have done is it's kind of reawakened his interest in spirituality, not necessarily Christianity. As he said in last week's episode, he has no desire to set foot back in a church again. But one thing that comes across in this and last week's episode is that you can't disguise his love for learning and religion and spirituality just to see how it functions and how it has functioned 25, 30, 40,000 years ago and exploring what all of that means. So I really hope that you've been challenged and stimulated and maybe even had your mind blown a little bit with this and last week's episode. I'll just conclude this week's episode by saying that if you want to get a hold of me, there's a variety of ways that you can do that on social media, and all those links are in the show notes, as well as how you can become a supporter of this show on Patreon. That is also in the show notes, the link to my Patreon page. So please take a look at that. I'll also just say real quickly that there's another way you can support the show, and that is by buying a Mindshift Podcast t-shirt. There's a couple of designs that I've recently uploaded to TeePublic, and I put a link to this in the show notes as well. Right now they're on sale for just $14. Normally they'd be $20. So you can support the show by proudly displaying the fact that you're a Mindshift Podcast supporter. Next week, don't forget, coming up is the first half of my discussion with David Fitzgerald. We're going to be talking about the historicity of Jesus over the next couple of weeks. This is an absolutely fascinating and challenging conversation, so be sure and come back for that with David. All right, thanks again for listening in. I've been your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. Thank you for joining myself and Andrew Gurvich for these last two episodes. Don't forget, next week, David Fitzgerald, so come back, check it out, right here on Mindshift Podcast.